he reached up and he grabbed me right there. And he squeezed me hard, real hard. And he said, stop fucking around.
In the year of 1999, as many as over 287 million individuals visited national parks all across the United States. Among them was Carlsbad Caverns National Park in southeastern New Mexico. This national park is most known for its meandering underground cave that is home to thousands of Mexican free-tailed bats. Nestled within the expanse of this national park lies the remote and rugged Rattlesnake Canyon, which can be accessed via various trails. This canyon is only for the most experienced hikers, and its isolation offers them a chance to immerse themselves in its untamed wilderness. Despite its name, which is inspired by the slithering inhabitants that traverse its rocky terrain, Rattlesnake Canyon boasts a diverse ecosystem, teeming with life adapted to the harsh desert environment. However, amidst the allure of its natural beauty, the canyon harbors its own set of hazards for unwary or unexperienced adventurers. The desert climate of southeastern New Mexico can be merciless, especially during the scorching summer months when temperatures soar above 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Heat-related illnesses, such as heatstroke and dehydration, pose significant risk to hikers, exacerbated by the limited access to water sources within the canyon. Furthermore, the remoteness of Rattlesnake Canyon presents additional challenges. Its secluded location means that cellular service is virtually non-existent, leaving visitors without a means to call for help in case of emergencies. In 1999, two men from Massachusetts discovered firsthand just how unforgiving the terrain of Rattlesnake Canyon can be. While the two men had set off on their camping expedition together, only one of them would return home. David Coughlin was born on the 12th of February 1973 to parents Robert and Joyce in Connecticut in the United States of America. During David's childhood, the Coughlin family relocated to Wellesley Hills in Massachusetts. David navigated his way through high school with ease, culminating in his graduation from UMass Amherst in the mid-1990s. Known for his wisdom beyond his years and his eagerness to assist others, David was hailed as an intelligent and mature individual. By summer of 1999, he bid farewell to his position at Wellesley Town Hall to pursue higher education at the University of California in Santa Barbara. Over his four-year employment there, he had left his mark in various roles, including the assessor's office, the planning board, and the selectman's office. His most recent post as a traffic policy analyst was tailored to his calm demeanor, which proved invaluable in navigating stressful situations. Colleagues such as accountant Ann Collins fondly reminisced about David's impact, stating, "Everybody loved him. He was the nicest guy in the world. Some people just pass through your life and don't make a mark, but he was wonderful." Despite not having children of his own, David took immense pride in being an uncle, adorning his desk at work with photographs of his nieces and nephews. Now embarking on a new chapter, David had secured admission to pursue a graduate degree in environmental policy at UC Santa Barbara. He tendered his resignation on the 15th of July, 1999, preparing for a cross-country journey slated for departure on the 24th or 25th, covering a distance of 3,000 miles over to Santa Barbara. The plan was for David to drive there alone. But when he ran his plan over with his best friend, Rafi Kudikian, everything changed. Rafi was originally from Doylestown in Pennsylvania, but he had since moved to Boston. He had graduated with honors from Northeastern University in 1997, with a bachelor's degree in journalism. But he was currently working for a financial services company in downtown Boston.
I worked in the correspondence department. My job was to correspond with customers, explain legal requirements to them as far as their accounts went.
Rafi was an avid adventurer, once publishing a two-part series on his 10-week, 13,000-mile journey across 25 states in the Boston Globe. During his adventure, he had visited the deserts of New Mexico, where he had to sleep by a stream in Truth or Consequences, and locked himself out of his jeep during a sandstorm at White Sands. Rafi described his travels in the piece, writing, "I had travelled through deserts, grasslands, mountains, prairies, swamps, rain, and a sandstorm. My trip has been caked on my tires, dripped on my boots, and seared into my memory as one of the greatest experiences I could have imagined. And God willing, I'll get the chance to do it again." When David broached the subject of his cross-country adventure, Rafi saw an opportunity to reconnect with the wilderness again, this time with his best friend. David and Rafi had met back in university, and they hit it off immediately. They had bonded over their love for nature, and while Rafi found solace in the written word, David captured the world's beauty through the lens of his camera. Their friendship blossomed over countless conversations, outings to bars, movie nights, and adrenaline-fueled adventures on skis, bikes, and snowboards. When David proposed his plan, Rafi eagerly suggested that he join him on the road trip to California, and suggested that they could stop at various sites along the way.
He was talking about the trip and getting excited about it, and he kind of got my juices going about it, and so I decided I was going to see what I could do about getting off from work.
Rafi took a leave from work, and on the 29th of July, 1999, he and David set off together. The journey's endpoint would be David's family home, where their paths would diverge. David beginning his studies in California, and Rafi returning to Boston. In anticipation of their trip, David's girlfriend, Sonnet Frost, gifted him with a notebook to chronicle their adventures. David and Rafi embarked on their cross-country trip towards the end of July 1999. They stopped off in Nashville, Memphis, New Orleans, and Austin, staying at campsites along the way. After roughly 6 days on the road, they found themselves at Carlsbad Caverns National Park, a destination that neither had experienced before, but were eager to explore. Arriving on the 4th of August, David and Rafi stocked up on 3 liters of water and secured a 2-day camping permit from the visitor center.
I remember him telling us about no campfires in the park, pack out what you pack in. He told us the recommendation about the amount of water we should take. It was a gallon per day.
Their plan was to spend a night camping in the park before exploring the caves the next morning. Since they weren't going to be there long, they decided to bring less water than what was recommended by the park rangers.
We were just spending the night there. We weren't planning on spending an entire day. We weren't planning on touring the canyon. We took less water than we needed.
They specifically aimed to camp at the Rattlesnake Canyon area. And with their permit in hand, they set off towards the trailhead nearest their chosen spot. They parked their car close to the trailhead, shouldered their gear, and then ventured into the rugged terrain of the canyon. As they trekked towards their camping spot, they steadily drank half of their water supply. They arrived just before dusk descended and set up camp at the canyon's base. They kindled a fire and used another quarter of their water to boil some hot dogs and corn for dinner. By the next morning, their water supply was almost completely gone. While they had both camped before, they found themselves ill-prepared for the intense heat of New Mexico's desert. They needed to replenish their water supply, so decided on packing up and returning to the visitor's center before embarking on their tour of the caves. Where they had chosen to camp lacked signs, but had small rock cairns that guided people on their way, but as two young men from Boston, David and Rafi weren't familiar with how they worked. They set off on foot and were armed with a topographic map that they hoped would lead them back to their car. However, they went the wrong way. As they realised their error, David and Rafi found themselves lost under the scorching sun, their water supply dwindling rapidly. In the relentless heat, with temperatures soaring over 100 degrees, they trudged through the desert landscape, their desperation growing with each passing moment. By midday, they had exhausted their water reserves and any semblance of direction. Over the ensuing hours, they descended further into Rattlesnake Canyon, with the unforgiving terrain closing in around them. With no relief in sight, their bodies were weakened by dehydration and fatigue, and they were unable to ascend the steep canyon walls to gain a vantage point. With no alternative, they pitched their tent on the canyon floor, restless and delirious throughout the night. Come morning, their judgment was clouded by exhaustion, and they made the ill-fated decision to push forward rather than retrace their steps. Rafi's fleeting glimpse of distant lights the night before fueled their hope. But it was only driving them deeper into the harsh wilderness. Their optimism waned as the reality of their situation became undeniable. There were no roads ahead, no visitor centre in sight, only the vast expanse of barren terrain, stretching endlessly before them. Aware of the grim reality of their situation, David and Rafi confronted the harsh truth. The longer they remained stranded in the desert, the slimmer their chances of survival became. In a sombre acknowledgement of their mortality, David turned to his notebook. He was determined to leave behind a record of their ordeal, uncertain if it would ever be discovered. He penned their dire circumstances, writing, "Nobody has come. We were planning to die. We mustered up all of our strength. We had no food or water. Nobody has come. We went back to camp in hopes St. Nicholas would have fucking shown up. Nobody has come. No water was left. We thought we had found the way out and set off Saturday. It wasn't it."
We were expecting to die in that canyon. We weren't fooling ourselves. We didn't have the luxury of hope. We felt that if anyone ever read this, that we would be dead.
That night, as David and Rafi lay vulnerable beneath the vast desert sky, the presence of circling vultures cast a shadow over their already bleak situation. In a defiant act of resilience, David wrote in his notebook, "We will not let the buzzards get us alive. God forgive us."
Friday was when we first noticed the birds. They were probably about 30 feet above us. They would just stick around and watch us. We would wave our arms to let them know that we were still alive. And they disappear, and then they come back about an hour later.
With the dawn of a new day, David proposed a desperate plan to retrace their steps back to their initial campsite. Despite their weakened state, they were fueled by sheer determination, and they embarked on the journey forward. Their bodies were ravaged by days without water, suffering from sunburn, heat stroke, and dehydration, but they pressed on. In a desperate bid to alleviate their thirst, they resorted to consuming cactus fruit, but the meager amount of liquid offered little relief. Aware of the urgent need for hydration to survive and navigate their way back to safety, they then resorted to drastic measures. Their desperation drove them to drink their own urine, unaware of the harm that it could cause. Urine is composed of waste products and toxins that the body is trying to eliminate, so drinking it can introduce those harmful substances back into the body. Urine is also high in sodium, which can further dehydrate the body and worsen the dehydration over time. It can also lead to gastrointestinal discomfort and potential infections. As night fell, the grim reality of their situation sank in, and David was confronted with the dire consequences of his actions. He had bouts of uncontrollable vomiting, and he endured a sleepless night in agony from severe cramps and aching muscles. The toll of the exhaustion weighed heavily on his body and mind. Over the course of the night, David had come to terms with his own fate. He had accepted that he was going to die in the desert, and his best friend was most likely going to die with him. The two men began discussing suicide, but first they made a last-ditch attempt to get help by burning a number of their possessions. David was in so much pain that he began screaming into the vast openness, hoping that somebody somewhere could hear him.
Eventually he started yelling for a doctor. I didn't have the heart to tell him that nobody was listening. So I started yelling with him. And then he stopped yelling. And he looked at me and he said, "I just realized." And I said, "What?" And he said, "This is it."
At this point, David and Rafi devised a plan to end their lives together. But they found themselves lacking in resolve. Rafi was the stronger of the two. So they decided that he would slit his wrists and then help David to slit his. However, the knife was apparently too blunt and only left superficial injuries, so they abandoned that idea. The next morning, David wrote a final letter to his girlfriend, Sonnet, which read, "Sonnet, baby, I write this with a shaking hand. I do not know what to do right now, but I am in utter agony, and I know you would understand. I love you so much. I've barely eaten and drank since Wednesday evening. Nobody is coming to help. I love you. We had forever, but all we have is eternity. Eternally yours, David Andrew." Meanwhile, Rafi documented his sentiments in the shared notebook the same day, writing, "Dave has asked that his remains be cremated and thrown over the edge of the Grand Canyon. I leave the handling of my remains to my family." After David and Rafi failed to show up at the park visitor center after 2 days to sign out, park rangers weren't immediately concerned. Extended stays by campers were not uncommon at the canyon. However, as 2 more days passed without any sign of the pair, the rangers became increasingly worried. On the 8th of August, the same day that David penned his farewell to his girlfriend, park ranger Lance Madison made a crucial discovery. At the Rattlesnake Canyon trailhead, he stumbled upon David's 1994 Mazda Prodigy, parked in a remote section of the park, seldom visited by tourists due to its isolated nature. Unlike the bustling trails marked with clear signage, this area remained largely untouched. The sight of the abandoned vehicle heightened Lance's concerns. Knowing that David and Rafi had yet to return from their camping trip, he quickly organized a search. Maneuvering through the narrow trails and rugged terrain, the park ranger diligently combed the area. He scanned the canyon walls and crevices for any signs of the missing men. The treacherous landscape posed numerous hazards. Deep crevices and steep cliffs where the two could have potentially fallen or become trapped. Fearing the worst, Lance braced himself for the possibility of severe injury or worse, realizing that time was of the essence in his search efforts. About 30 minutes into the search, Lance reached a vantage point on the trail and spotted a camp nestled at the bottom of a rocky, dried stream bed. Descending to the canyon floor, he found Rafi lying beneath a tarp underneath the scorching summer sun. Rafi lay approximately 275 feet from a trail and about a mile and a half from David's abandoned car. Approaching Rafi, Lance noted signs of severe sunburn and dehydration. Clad only in his shorts, Rafi bore scrapes and bruises from navigating the rugged backcountry terrain. Upon seeing Lance, Rafi desperately said, "Please tell me you brought water." Handing over his canteen, Lance watched as Rafi eagerly gulped down the liquid, only to promptly vomit it back up. Lance then inquired about the whereabouts of Rafi's friend, David. Rafi pointed over towards a small pile of rocks on the desert ground and said, "I killed him." Lance immediately reached out to park rangers at Carlsbad National Park to cooperate a rescue operation led by Mark Mercia. Beside the rocks that Rafi had pointed at, a distress signal spelled out SOS with more stones. In close proximity, Lance found a blue sleeping pad, a blood-smeared t-shirt, and a sock. Lance swiftly attended to Rafi, who showed signs of severe dehydration. His pulse raced at 125 beats per minute, and his skin bore the telltale signs of dehydration. He exhibited extreme weakness and disorientation, requiring immediate attention. Have you ever Googled your name? Brace for a shock. Your personal data, from addresses to phone numbers, is often freely available, harvested by data brokers. That's where Aura steps in to protect you. Aura scans the web for sensitive information such as emails, passwords, and social security numbers. You can receive real-time alerts if anything is found. Aura also advocates for your privacy by removing your data from broker sites, putting you back in control. Are you tired of spam calls and junk mail? Well, Aura has you covered. And if you're a victim of identity theft, their fraud resolution team provides white glove assistance. With Aura, safeguarding your digital identity is easier than ever. For a limited time, Aura is offering Morbidology listeners a 14-day free trial, plus a check of your data to see if your personal information has been leaked online, all for free, when you visit aura.com/morbidology. That's aura.com/morbidology to sign up for a 14-day free trial and start protecting you and your loved ones. That is aura.com/morbidology. Certain terms apply, so be sure to check the site for details. While providing first aid, Lance probed Rafi for details. Initially suspecting an accidental tragedy, Lance considered the possibility that David had succumbed to the elements or even had a fatal fall. He thought that when Rafi said that he killed him, he meant that he felt responsible because he had suggested the camping trip. However, Rafi's shocking revelation contradicted these assumptions. Rafi recounted their desperate struggle for survival. He detailed how they became lost without water and lacked the strength to hike out of the canyon by the third day. Rafi explained the excruciating pain they endured from dehydration, describing symptoms such as muscle cramps, headaches, and joint pains, all exacerbated by decreased blood flow. As their water supply dwindled and their strength waned, they faced the grim reality of impending death. The gravity of their situation forced them to confront the inevitability of their fate, as they realized that they were too weakened to find their way back to safety. David, in particular, was experiencing unbearable, excruciating pain, and his mental state was becoming severely affected by the dehydration. Rafi said that he and David had made a suicide pact just hours before he was discovered. After David had written one final goodbye to Sonnet, he turned to Rafi and begged him to put him out of his misery.
He turned to me and he said, "You've got to end this." And at first I wasn't really sure what he meant. And he said, "Get the knife." And I said, "No." He said, "You know they're not coming." And I said, "Yeah, no, they're not coming." He said, "Then get the fucking knife." So I did. And he said, put it through my chest. I was bawling. I got next to him, and I pushed it through his chest. But I fucked up, and I hit his lung. Because when I pulled the knife out, air came out. I told him I had to do it again. And he said, okay. And this time, I thought I hit his heart. Blood came out. And he said, pull it out. And I did. And I asked him if he was still in pain, and he said no. He said he felt a lot better, and he smiled. I held his hand the whole time. He was he started getting weak, and I covered his face with a t-shirt, and he died.
Rafi said that he felt like he had no other choice than to kill David.
I could have crawled out from under the tent and gotten away from him and just listened to his pain from a distance. Yeah, I could have done that.
He told Lance that he then buried him in a makeshift grave and passed out from the exhaustion. Just a mere 3 hours later, Rafi was discovered by Lance. Lance then asked Rafi for the knife and asked whether he had any other weapons, but he said that he didn't. Lance then proceeded to investigate the scene, discovering David's makeshift grave. As he moved some of the rocks, he spotted a cloth that had a bump resembling a human nose. Deciding not to investigate any further, Lance returned to Rafi.
I didn't make any reference to his friend's body or anything. We didn't want to jeopardize any element of the investigation.
Shortly thereafter, Mark Mercia arrived at the canyon. He arranged for Rafi to be airlifted by a military helicopter to a nearby hospital, as arrangements were made for David's body to be transported to the medical examiner's office. Since David's body was discovered in a national park, the case was investigated by the FBI and the National Park Service, in addition to the Eddy County Sheriff's Office. Upon arrival at the hospital, Rafi received a diagnosis of hypernatremia, indicating severe dehydration. Medical professionals administered intravenous fluids and ordered comprehensive blood tests to assess his condition. Results revealed a dangerously elevated sodium level of 174, far beyond the normal range. Additionally, Rafi's blood urea nitrogen to creatinine ratio stood at 23:1, indicative of dehydration, as a ratio higher than 10:1 suggests. Further analysis indicated that Rafi's hydration was at a level of a mere 13%. According to experts, anybody with a hydration level below 15% would experience agonizing symptoms, hindering their ability to walk or stand. In the legal realm, Rafi faced a charge of open count of murder in connection with David's death, with bail set at $50,000 in cash. This designation signified that detectives had yet to determine the precise degree of the charge against Rafi. Sheriff Chunky Click of Eddy County said to the public, "Until the investigation is more complete, we can't specify whether it's first degree, second degree, third degree, or fourth degree." Despite the charge, Rafi was released on bond under the condition that he remain within Eddy County boundaries pending further developments in the case. As he was released, David's autopsy was performed. The pathologist, Dr. Dennis Klein, found that he had been stabbed twice in the left side of his chest. He had died from internal bleeding that had caused too much pressure on his heart. The pathologist found signs of dehydration, and his hydration level was at 12%. He concluded that David was moderately to severely dehydrated when he was killed, and ruled that his manner of death was homicide. At this juncture, detectives harbored doubts regarding Rafi's narrative surrounding David's death, despite diary entries that had been written by both of them detailing their ordeal. Detectives didn't believe that David would have been in so much pain and discomfort that he would have preferred to be stabbed to death. Further raising suspicions was Rafi's assertion that the knife lacked the sharpness necessary for suicide, despite its efficiency in ending David's life. Sheriff Click characterized the case as very bizarre, expressing doubt at the notion of someone killing their best friend, even in adverse circumstances. As detectives combed through the campsite that David and Rafi had occupied, they stumbled upon untouched provisions, a large can of baked beans and bread. This struck detectives as suspicious, given the potential hydration and nutrition these items could have provided. However, the debilitating effects of dehydration on bodily functions, including reduced saliva production and impaired digestion, could explain the lack of appetite and difficulty in consuming food. In their scrutiny of Rafi's motives, detectives uncovered his profession as a writer, prompting consideration of the possibility that he had orchestrated the incident as a sensational narrative to exploit for profit. They didn't think it was plausible that Rafi and David were truly lost in the desert. Their campsite was just 250 feet from the trail and over a mile away from their parked car. Had they scaled the canyon's heights, the park's visitor center would have loomed into view. Yet Rafi contended that they were too exhausted to even begin considering climbing to the top of the canyon. Detectives couldn't help but find it perplexing how, if Rafi was indeed as feeble as he claimed, he managed to bury David beneath some rocks. Detectives persisted in their inquiries, initiating interviews with David and Rafi's friends and family. Their aim was to figure out if there was any bad blood between the two men. However, accounts from their social circle painted a picture of unwavering friendship. According to their friend Sandy Hobson, they were best friends for ages. They were very, very close. While the detectives were suspicious of Rafi's account, the media was much more forgiving. They reported on the case, referring to it as a mercy killing, although there is no law in New Mexico that excuses murder under the theory of a mercy killing. Rafi hired Gary Mitchell as his defense attorney, and he made some comments in the media. He said that David's autopsy, which showed he was moderately too severely dehydrated, confirmed Rafi's story. He stated, "It just verified that it was a horrible situation for two young men in the high desert of New Mexico, who forgot that Mother Nature can be pretty brutal. It's a real tragedy." He also said, "Both boys couldn't stand what was about to happen to them. That is, a slow death. And one friend did what his other friend suggested and ended it. There wasn't any malice or evil, just your best buddy doing what your other best buddy begged for, because they thought it was the end." While David's bladder was found to be full at the autopsy, the pathologist still said that he was in such a state of dehydration that he likely suffered some degree of delirium and pain. Nevertheless, Sheriff Click dismissed the significance of these findings. He focused on David's cause of death, two stab wounds to the chest, stating, "If the report says he died of dehydration, that would be different, but it says two stab wounds to the chest." In addition to the autopsy report, documented accounts from both David and Rafi corroborated their harrowing ordeal in Rattlesnake Canyon. The final entry, which was scribed by Rafi, painted a grim picture of his agonizing decision. "I killed and buried my best friend today. David had been in pain all night. At around 5 or 6, he turned to me and begged that I put my knife through his chest. I did, and a second time when he wouldn't die. He still breathed and spoke, so I told him that I was going to cover his face. He said okay. He struggled, but died. I buried him with love. God and his family and mine, please forgive me." Some desert survival experts weighed in on the case, and they came to Rafi's defense as well. They all warned the public against trying to rationalize what might happen in such a situation. David Alloway, who teaches a desert survival workshop at Texas Big Ranch State Park, stated, "When you start going into dehydration, you start making very irrational decisions. I've seen where people have done some silly things." On the 14th of August, Rafi was allowed to return home under certain agreements. He needed to abstain from alcohol and drugs, contact his attorney at least once a week, and avoid all contact with potential witnesses, including David's family. Despite what had happened, David's family stood by Rafi and offered him their support. His brother Michael asked around 400 people to pray for Rafi during David's funeral. They had all packed into St. James Catholic Church, as Michael said to them. "I know how much he loved David, and I know how much my brother loved him." However, not everybody in David's circle was so forgiving. One of his long-term friends, Kristen Fisher, shared with the media, "There's no way in the world he would have ever asked anyone to do that. He was one of the most non-confrontational person I had ever known. I don't even remember him ever getting into a fist fight with anyone." During the funeral service, David was remembered as a sensible, hard-working, steady young man with an infectious sense of humour and zest for life. His sister Kathleen Powell read a poem by Ralph Waldo Emerson that she said reminded her of her brother. Through tears, Kathleen said, "To know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived. This is to have succeeded." Rafi returned to his parents' home in Pennsylvania, where he received support from the community. One of the family's neighbours, George Rummel, commented, "I've known Rafi since he was a toddler. I've never heard an unkind word come out of his mouth." Some people even placed the blame on the park rangers, saying that they should have searched for David and Rafi much sooner. Rafi's murder trial was scheduled for May of 2000, and the prosecution shared that they were seeking a first-degree murder conviction that would come with a mandatory life sentence. Rafi's defense attorney, Gary Mitchell, announced that he should be able to argue to a jury that dehydration caused Rafi to suffer the equivalent of involuntary intoxication. However, District Judge Jay Forbes ruled that he couldn't use this defense and noted that a jury instruction of diminished responsibility was more appropriate to the case. He said that the definition of involuntary intoxication required introducing a substance into the body. He also noted that New Mexico courts don't allow consideration of diminished capacity in second-degree murder cases, only first-degree. By now, Rafi had been charged with second-degree murder, and his defense attorney then shared that he was planning on pleading no contest. This meant that he would neither admit nor deny guilt or liability, but instead that he would not protest the charge or present a defense. It has a similar legal consequence to pleading guilty. The court hearing was scheduled for the 8th of May. That morning, Rafi arrived in court, where he pleaded no contest to second-degree murder. His defense attorney, Gary Mitchell, announced that he was planning on calling survival witnesses, telling the judge, "You start understanding people in dehydrated states do some crazy things." He described David and Rafi as the best of friends, who never meant any harm to nobody, including themselves, before telling the judge, "They get lost, have no water for 3 days, are severely dehydrated, both in extreme agony and both attempt suicide. David pleads with Rafi to end his life, and Rafi, in what most people call a mercy killing, does as his friend wishes." The courtroom was shown a video of the campsite, including David's body in his shallow grave. Rafi dropped his head and covered his eyes at the sight of his friend's body. 2 stab wounds pierced his blue plaid shirt. According to experts who testified during the hearing, both men were dehydrated enough to be in pain. However, they said that David would have survived if he had not have been stabbed. But there was no way that Rafi and David knew that help was coming for them that day, and both had presumed that they were going to eventually die in the desert. Dr. Klein detailed his findings at autopsy, but said he couldn't determine exactly whether David would have lived if he had not have been stabbed. In the hushed courtroom, all eyes turned towards Rafi as he took to the witness stand. With a solemn demeanor, he recounted their harrowing journey through the unforgiving desert.
In hindsight, our first big mistake as far as getting lost went was when we got to the bottom of the entrance trail, we didn't turn around and look back at what we had just come down out of. We were looking ahead. We stopped for a couple minutes and had some water, but we didn't really look around to check out our surroundings.
He described their ill-fated decision to retrace their steps, only to find themselves on the wrong trail, leading them further into the wilderness. Rafi's composure wavered as he recounted their suicide attempts. He spoke of David's suffering the night before he died, telling the courtroom that he had been in so much pain that he couldn't even lie down. The next morning, he stabbed David twice in the chest after his best friend begged him to. He recalled how David said that it hurt, and then he died. He told the courtroom, "It was the last thing that I could do for him. I covered him as best I could. It was not something I wanted to do. It was something I had to do." Rafi described burying David and said that he was so exhausted afterwards that he passed out. He eventually came to just as Lance had found him. Prosecutor Les Williams asked him if he had thought about what he was doing, to which Rafi replied,
"What I thought I was doing was keeping my friend from going through 12 to 24 hours of hell before he died."
Prosecutor Williams then questioned, "It wasn't mental illness that made you kill him. It was mercy?" Rafi responded, "That's the way I see it, yeah." Rafi described David as the closest thing he had to a brother. After Rafi stepped on from the witness stand, Prosecutor Williams presented his closing arguments. He questioned just how resolved Rafi was to kill himself. He raised the knife that Rafi had used to kill David and said, "This knife is sharp enough to cut your wrist, and it is sharp enough to go through your chest. The only reason he did not commit suicide is where there is life, there is hope. The defendant is not an evil man. He's not a bad person. He did do a bad thing, and he did it knowingly and purposefully." State District Judge Jay Forbes then sentenced Rafi to 15 years in prison, but suspended all but a 2-year prison term, which was to be followed by 5 years of probation. It was a victory in Rafi's eyes, because he could have been sentenced for up to 20 years in prison. Judge Forbes said that he didn't question whether Rafi's remorse was genuine, but said that he still deserved to be punished. Rafi provided a comment afterwards stating, "I feel that anybody in my position who would turn their back on their friend wouldn't have been deserving of coming out of that canyon." He said that he still loved David and that he always would, before adding, "I frequently feel that if one of us should have come out of that canyon, both of us should have. It's not fair that only one of us made it out of there." Outside of court, Rafi's defense attorney said that the sentence was extremely fair and said that both families just wanted to put the ordeal behind them. David's family wasn't in court for the sentencing, but they had prepared a statement.
"David and Rafi were friends. We can think of no reason why Rafi would have wished David any harm or pain. To be sure, we have questions. However, we find it difficult to believe there was any malicious intent."
While Sheriff Click had been suspicious of Rafi's account early on in the investigation, he shared that he truly believed his story now. On the 4th of March 2002, Rafi was released from prison after serving 19 months. He moved back to Pennsylvania before settling down in San Francisco, California, where he has since forged out a successful career in insurance. The American Southwest deserts, renowned for their breathtaking beauty, serve as sanctuaries for those yearning for solitude and spiritual rejuvenation. Yet these landscapes can also be harsh and unforgiving, as David Coughlin tragically discovered firsthand. Despite the judge's acknowledgements of Rafi Kurikian's story, public opinion remains sharply divided on whether true justice was served. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Nicole. You can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. I upload ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes, behind the scenes, and I also send out a thank you card along with some merch. Today's episode was a little bit different than anything else I've ever covered on the show, and I'm really, really, really curious to hear your thoughts on it. I have a private Facebook group for the podcast, and I'd love for some of you to share your thoughts on this episode up on there. What do you think happened out in the desert? Do you think the true justice was served? Or should Rafi have served more time? Just search for Morbidology up on Facebook and the group should pop up. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read some true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.